Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 144. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at two incredibly different movies. The first one is from 1942, and it's Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be, starring Jack Benny and Carol Lombard. And then we go totally into the 1990s action film genre with 1991's The Last Boy Scout, starring Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans, directed by Tony Scott. Like I said, incredibly different movies. The first one was picked out by Morris, one of our Patreon subscribers and a good friend of the podcast. And the second one was picked by me because I think it's one of the best of the 1990s, late 1980s, early 1990s action genre films for a number of different reasons. So sit back, relax, grab a drink, do whatever you need to do. And in a moment after I do the contact details, we'll get on with talking about the films. And the other good thing is, too, we have some feedback. So just sit back, relax, and I'll get on with the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it.
It helps if you turn the microphone on. How is everybody across this clay and granite planet today? We're doing okay here. Spring is springing, and everything is going groovy in that regard. In about a week and a half, I'm going to be up in Sydney to give away my sister at her wedding, so I'm looking forward to doing that. I've actually got to get some podcasts under my belt before then, so it's all going to be chaos and rushing and hurry and all sorts of things like that, but it's all good. And I want to thank Morris again, one of the great friends of our podcast, and he and I talk at work via messaging a fair bit about the podcast and about other things as well, because we both happen to work for the same company. But Morris is a Patreon subscriber, and he suggested that I look at the first of the two movies today, To Be or Not to Be, from 1942. So thanks for that, Morris. Let's see what else has been happening. I'll go through the stuff I've been watching and what I thought about it. But before I do that, Pop Culture, one of the places that sells online in Australia, lots of pop culture memorabilia and things like that. They also have a store down in Geelong. They had a warehouse sale on Friday this week, and Sal and I ripped down there and decided we were going to be a part of it. There were incredibly long lines of people, but we were near the front of the line, which was good. They were selling a lot of stuff with damaged packaging, so all these pop culture figures, and there were a lot of pop vinyl things and great big maquettes and all sorts of stuff they were selling off really cheaply. So we filled up a box full of stuff, and one of the things I got, which is incredibly groovy, is a Zuni fetish doll from Trilogy of Terror, the TV movie starring Karen Black from the 1970s. Now, the head was busted off it and the spear was broken, but we repaired that. And I got it for $10. Now, they're selling new in the box on eBay for about $350. Not that I'd sell it, and it's not in mint condition by any means, but we repaired it up so it looks really great. And $10, I mean, really. And the other thing is, I got a nice little kind of 12-inch figure, a little bit more than 12-inch figure, of the Fly from The Return of the Fly, the 1959 sequel to the original version of the Fly. Now, this isn't your David Cronenberg Fly. This is the one that's a bit like this. Yeah, so we've got a really groovy figure of that. Sal picked up a whole bunch of stuff that she likes as well, but we got out of there really, really cheaply and ended up with a whole bunch of nice little collectibles for decorating around. We've done a bit of a renovation on the man cave as well, and there's a few changes being made to that, which I kind of enjoy. Put in a lot more shelving so that a lot of things are on the shelves now rather than just stacked up in the closet. and it's all going ahead really nicely. So all of that's been happening. But to get on with the movies I've been watching, let me just bring up the Letterboxd. Let's have a look since I've last done this. I did a very good film noir called The Trap, which stars Richard Widmark, Lee J. Cobb, Tina Louise and Earl Holliman. It's one of those desert film noirs from the late 1950s, which is kind of groovy and some really good intense acting. So I really enjoyed watching that. Let's see. I watched Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise science fiction actioner. I've still got a conceptual problem with Tom Cruise as an actor. I think that there's something off about him. It's an elusive, and maybe it's just personal taste, I don't know, but there's something about him that I don't like as an actor. And I think that it's like, rather, there's a facade there that you can't break through, and that I find a bit annoying. So there was that. And let's see, what else I watched? I rewatched a favourite musical of mine, It's Always Fair Weather, which stars Dan Daly, Michael Kidd, and Gene Kelly, with Cicherice and a bunch of other people in it. And yeah, it was kind of cool. Really enjoyed watching that again, which was fun. Now, the other thing I've been doing is I've been mainlining episodes of an anime TV series called Yu-Gi-Oh!, which I kind of like. And then when I start exercising, because I do exercise on an elliptical machine, though my photos wouldn't suggest that I do any exercise at all. But I've been kind of mainlining episodes of that while exercising, and they're kind of fun. I watched them about 10 years ago when they were really popular, and I've been watching them again. And that's kind of cut down my movie watching to a certain extent, being addicted to that. I watched Real Genius, the Martha Coolidge movie with Val Kilmer in it, about the kind of nerd scientist guys from about 1985. And I enjoyed that again. First two movies of Val Kilmer are among his best, really, this one and Top Secret. And I kind of reinvigorated myself by watching that. I did see a pre-code movie from 1933, Ida Lupino's first American movie after she came across the pond. And it's called Search for Beauty, which also stars Buster Crabb. And it's about some people who decide to start an exercise farm for rich people and all sorts of things. But the weird thing about it is they've got all of these really fit-looking people from the 1930s, and there's a lot of near nudity in it, which is kind of weird. All the women in the exercise gear aren't wearing bras, and there's a bit of camel toe and all sorts of things. And for a pre-code, even for a pre-code movie before the Hays Code came in, it's pretty raw, and it was a little bit of fun too. I think that it's not perfect by any means, but it's just kind of interesting to see what was considered risque in the 1930s, and this indeed was. And it's interesting seeing Ida Lupino acting with her original English accent rather than the acquired American accent that we know her with. So I watched that more for historic purposes than anything, he said, with no shred of guilt at all. But yeah, that's pretty much what I've been watching. Not a lot there. I did rewatch also my favourite movie of all time, The Bad and the Beautiful. Liz Travaskis and I were going to do it for the radio gig on Friday night, Thursday night. But Liz has come down with the flu. And at the last minute, I ended up doing something totally different with Tim Brunero from ABC Alice Springs. Last minute, this is like 10 minutes before I leave work and about an hour before I'm supposed to be on air. Tim called me up and said, Liz is sick, we've got to do something and I haven't seen the movie. So I quickly printed out a whole bunch of stuff on the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and Tim Brunero and I had a bit of a chat for about 15 or 20 minutes on air, live. He called me at home. And we did that live about the Marvel Cinematic Universe for ABC Northern Territory, and I think it went over well. He friended me up on Facebook, so that's something at least, I suppose. But it was very much a last minute, what do you need, how can we do it? Quickly print some stuff out on the printer at work, take it home, rewatch all of the trailers for all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, and then try to wax eloquent about them on the radio. I think it worked, but It just goes to show that these things do happen when you kind of end up doing anything in the media at all, and you got to really roll with it and look at it as a challenge rather than a hassle. And that's exactly what I did, and we got through it. So next week we're going to be doing The Bad and the Beautiful, hopefully if Liz is back and is feeling better, and kind of groove on that, because I thought after I've done, yeah, what happens, the format for the thing is that somebody in the listening audience picks a genre and I've got to think of a movie for Liz and I to watch and talk about. So to take a break from that, I thought, we're going to do my movie for a change. We're going to do my favourite movie of all time. So we're doing The Bad and the Beautiful, the Vincente Minnelli movie from 1952, starring Kirk Douglas, Barry Sullivan, Lana Turner, Dick Powell, Walter Pigeon, Gilbert Roland, and also Gloria Graham in her Academy Award-winning role. So looking forward to doing that. It's a movie I know very well. It's a movie I did on a very, very early, like single-digit early, Paleo Cinema podcast. And I still found different things to say about it, which is probably the hallmark of a good movie. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to do these chronologically, and I'm going to talk about the 1942 Ernst Lubitsch comedy, To Be or Not to Be, starring Jack Benny and Carol Lombard. That, of course, was Melvin Kaminsky with the Hitler Rap, which was done as a promotional music video for To Be or Not to Be, the 1983 version starring Mr. Kaminsky, Anne Bancroft, Charles Durning, and a bunch of other actors. But I thought I'd throw that in because, you know, well, yeah, there's not too much music I could have thrown in from the original version. I kind of like that one anyway. Yeah, so 1942. to be or not to be. Now, again, this is another one of those movies that was made about the war and about Hitler and things like that while it was still going on. There are a lot of good English films, Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, Went the Day Well and things like that, which were kind of anti-Nazi movies made during the war. It's easy to do it afterwards. I mean, after the war's gone and Hitler is charcoal and all that kind of thing, it's dead easy to do a war movie and to be bold about it. But to do it while the whole lot's still going on is kind of has a certain gritty realism to it that gets it a lot more credit with me for some reason. But this one was great. The weird thing is I'd never seen it before Morris mentioned it to me. I'd seen the Mel Brooks version because I was kind of mainlining Mel Brooks movies whenever they came out at that stage. But back to the 1942 version. I found an even better premise, which is the one from Wikipedia. To Be or Not to Be is a 1942 American comedy directed by Ernst Lubitsch about a troupe of actors in Nazi-occupied Warsaw who use their abilities at disguise and acting to fool the occupying troops. That pretty much covers it, and the cast is pretty good and at times a little bit unusual. For instance, the young love interest is played by Robert Stack, who people remember from all sorts of things, most notably Airplane. But it's got Carol Lombard, Jack Benny, Robert Stack, as I said, Felix Bressart, Lionel Atwill, who people remember from a lot of Universal horror films, and Sig Ruman. So basically, the story is this, that Joseph Tura is an actor who runs an acting troupe in Poland just before and after the Nazis invade Poland, and he has a beautiful wife, Maria, played by Carol Lombard, very, very well, by the way. Carol basically decides to have an infatuation and probably an affair, though this is a postcode film, so you can't really say that, with a young airman played by Robert Stack. And the way she does it is in her dressing room, she waits for her lover in her dressing room, and as her husband starts his bit of Hamlet with to be or not to be, the young airman knows that that's his cue to leave the audience, go backstage and slip a length to Carol Lombard, to put it bluntly. But being an egotistical actor, Joseph Tura thinks that the guy's walking out on his soliloquy and he gets really upset about it. But his wife reassures him and all that kind of thing. That's the start of the film. Now, the airman, when the Nazis invade, goes to England and becomes part of the Polish contingent who joined the RAF to fight the Nazis at that time. And they did incredibly well, too. They punched well above their weight, as far as that's concerned. But they find out that one of the Polish expatriates in London is actually a Nazi spy. And they know he's going back to Warsaw briefly for a conference or something. And so they give him all of their family details so they can communicate with their families, because obviously with the Nazis around, they don't have too much contact with them, not realizing that he's going to give that information to the Gestapo and their families will be used as leverage against them. So they send back Robert Stack as the young airman to try to stop the professor. Now, his name is Professor Siletsky, played by Stanley Ridges. They've got to stop him. There's all this kind of stuff where they've got to stop Siletsky. Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of comedy things where it turns out that Joseph Tura has to impersonate Siletsky and pretend to be him when he talks to Gestapo and when he talks to various other people. Things go wrong, and it's kind of like this really weird French farce at times, except with Nazis and some various serious stuff happening as well. I'm going to play some bits from the movie, and then I'm going to talk about why I like it and why it wasn't particularly successful at the time it first came out.
Can it be true? It must be true, no doubt. The man with the little moustache, Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler in Warsaw, and all by himself?
War. It's really war. People are going to kill each other and be killed.
I wonder if you really know what Nazism stands for.
I have a slight idea.
They're gonna kill him! They're gonna kill him! You've got to do something! You've got to help him! Whenever I start to tell a story, you finish it. If I go on a diet, you lose the weight. If I have a cold, you cough. And if we should ever have a baby, I'm not so sure I'd be the mother.
I'm satisfied to be the father.
What he did to Shakespeare, we are doing now to Poland.
But he walked out on me.
Well, maybe he didn't feel well. Maybe he had to leave. Maybe he had a sudden heart attack.
I hope so.
If he stayed, he might have died.
Maybe he's dead already.
Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler!
Heil, Heil myself.
So they call me Concentration Camp Earhart.
So they call me Concentration Camp Earhart.
You know, you're quite famous in London, Colonel. They call you Concentration Camp Earhart.
Yes, yes. We do the concentrating and the Poles do the camping.
Naturally, in the theater, it's important that you choose the right part.
Very.
But in real life, it's even more important that you choose the right side.
Yep, there are actually concentration camp jokes in this movie, which can be excused because it wasn't until the liberation of Germany in 1945 that people knew exactly how monstrous and enormous and how disgusting concentration camps were. So we'll forgive them that. But the movie wasn't successful at the time. Now, there are a few reasons, one of which is that people thought it was too soon to make comedies about Hitler. Now, I kind of disagree, but I've got the advantage of 70-odd years of hindsight. But at the time, there was still in America a lot of sneaking sympathy for the Germans. Even though they were at war with them, there were, of course, people working against that. But the studio went ahead with the movie. Lubitsch directed it. It was directed on a story by Melchior Legiel, a Jewish writer. And it's really... From our viewpoint, and you've got to remember, yeah, 70 years have passed since this movie was made, and more, 72, I think. And we've got the advantage of knowing, yes, what the Nazis were and all that kind of thing. But at the time, the outcome of the war was uncertain. In America, they were fighting more against the Japanese than the Germans in some ways. And it was considered bad taste to make a comedy about the Germans while American soldiers were fighting against them. Now, whether that's right or not, I think it's wrong, but that's just me. But I kind of like the audacity of that. And the thing is, it does show you that the people were willing to go out on a limb and make these kind of comedies and mock the Nazis and mock the powerful German war machine and all that kind of thing. And this was at a time when the Germans were doing really, really well. But the other reason the movie was unsuccessful was this. 2 months before the release of the film, Carol Lombard died in a plane crash. She was married to Clark Gable at the time, which is not really has anything to do with the fact that the plane crashed. But she was very popular and people were kind of still grieving for her as a star and seeing her in a kind of light comedic role. And she is very, very good in it. Kind of, you know, reminded the audiences that she died recently. So it didn't make a lot of money, but long term it's been considered one of the great comedies of the era and one of Lubitsch's best as well. A lot of the other things he did didn't really have the edge of this film and didn't have that kind of topicality that To Be or Not To Be had at the time. And I kind of like it. I mean, Jack Benny's an actor and a character in media for whom I haven't really previously had a lot of time. I did see him in The Horn Blows at Midnight, which is one of his previous films from about 1935, and he was okay in that, but he's one of those performers whose manner dates badly in some ways, but in this one it doesn't really, and he gets some of the best lines in the film, and there are a few moments when he needs to, when he's pretending to be Seletsky particularly, when he does show some very adept acting chops. He is very good in the role, and he's great playing the kind of egotistical, cuckolded actor that he plays in this, and I kind of like that as well. Now, the other people in the cast are very good as well. The one that I really like is Felix Bressart playing Greenberg. Now, Greenberg wants to play Shylock in The Merchant of Venice really badly. It's the role of his life. It's the role he would love to do most. And the movie conspires to get him to be able to do it when surrounded by Nazi soldiers, which is lovely. And he and Bressart does a really nice job of portraying Shylock and being a German-Jewish immigrant actor at the time. I think there was a lot more passion in it than just an actor making an acting role. I think that kind of like the Marseillaise bit in Casablanca. It's one of those points in time and points in a film where an actor is allowed to show their real emotion. And I think that Bressart does that a lot. And in spite of that, it's not a heavy film by any means, but even though it does look at some very, very heavy themes, and Lubitsch does that very well. There's an incredibly sharp demarcation of Warsaw as it was before the invasion and afterwards. They kind of go along a row of shops showing all of the different Jewish-owned businesses on a particular street, and then they show it after the invasion. And basically the buildings are bomb sites and with barely legible signs on them. And that point is made for a specific purpose. So the cultural richness that is there is threatened by the Germans. And Lubitsch, in a very, very stylish manner, does portray that. And I like that. I like the fact that even though it's not particularly relative to the plot, it's very relative to the texture of the film and to the background of the actors doing what they do and the way that the war is. And I love those little bits of telling detail. There's another bit, too, where as the acting troupe are escaping, they see that the train station is on fire and, you know, basically burning down. And they love it because it proves that the resistance is still around and that the Germans didn't capture all the resistance fighters and the fight goes on. And that's kind of cool as well. An act of arson is seen as a good thing in this film. And, yeah, as indeed it was. And so it does give you that sense of time, that sense of topicality. And that it's something that through the medium of comedy, they're trying to get across to the American public exactly what's being lost by the invasions that the Germans were carrying out, the social infrastructures that were going, of course, the human life loss that was incurred. And they were willing to punch that in the face and to throw pies in its face as well. And I like that. I think it's easy to get... I mean, look at this way. We've got problems at the moment. We've got ISIL. We've got a whole bunch of other things going on too. And it's easy to get sucked into the vortex of that negativity and the vortex of that's horrible and that things are changing and things are never going to be the same and the world's going to shit. And there are about five or six times I've heard from different people over the past couple of months that the world's getting worse and things are going bad and all that. No, it isn't. There are a couple of things happening. And this is more true now than it was then because, of course, the World War was important then, as indeed are the fights against ISIL and all those people at the moment. But the thing to remember is the worst isn't the medium. The things that are going on that are really bad are not the only things going on. There are lots of positive things going on. There are fights being fought on a number of fronts that are winning. And for us to get involved too much in the negativity, even though there are going to be some really hard choices and hard things that a lot of young men and women are going to have to do to fix some of these really large wrongs in the world, it's not the end of things. Things will go on. And that's one of the things that this movie is saying. This movie is saying things go on. People survive, people thrive, people get sneaky, and people can outthink their enemies because their enemies only have a narrow vision. And that's a really good message to send anybody at any time in history, that the people who want to steamroller over everybody else have too narrow a focus. They're not seeing the really big picture. They're only seeing the picture they want to see. Whereas people who are of goodwill and who want the world to be a better place and not just a place of rules see a broader picture, see more things. And this movie, for that reason, does ring true now that, you know, there are things threatening all sorts of freedoms, Some of them are our governments, and some of them are sociopathic young men who want to have their own way and who get sucked into the belief systems of millennia past. But we'll get there. We'll get through this stuff. Just as during the war, people did get through it and things changed and things got better. And that's what I kind of took from watching To Be or Not To Be. The fact that even when things get dark, you can laugh about it. You can make comedy about it. You can mock your enemies. You can see that humor and resilience is a strength. And I kind of like that. For every asshole who wants to cut our heads off, there are 1,000 other people who just want to live their lives in the sunshine and kiss their kids and enjoy the world. And that's the message of that film, is that, yeah, these people are stupid, these people are cruel, but they're not going to win. And we should all remember that. Now, there's not much else to say about the film. The remake with Mel Brooks is a lot of fun and is a lot slapstick as well, and there are all sorts of good lines. Like in the Mel Brooks one, there's one of the actors' name is Sondheim, so Mel Brooks gets to say the classic line, "Sondheim, send in the clowns," and things like that. So they're kind of good companion pieces, the two films, but Mel Brooks has the virtue of hindsight, whereas Lubitsch... And remaking a Lubitsch film is a pretty of a gutsy move too. But if anybody had the right to, I think it was Mel Brooks, because he directly fought those bastards. And so that gives him the right to do whatever he likes as far as mocking the shit out of them. Not that anybody would stop anybody from doing it. And I'm waffling again. But anyway, To Be or Not To Be is a good film. And it's a fun film. It's a funny film. There are bits of it that are off-key, like the concentration camp jokes, and maybe still... with our hindsight, too raw to be as funny as that maybe they were at the time when people were a lot more ignorant about those things. But it is a good film, and it's an important film for the simple fact that it said things that needed to be said at the time. And it said it in an entertaining way, in a humorous way, and with a cast who do it justice. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to go totally different, totally in another direction, and look at early 1990s action film at, I think, its best. And that's the Tony Scott directed, Shane Black scripted 1991 action film, The Last Boy Scout, starring Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans.
Stands beside the river where you were to meet me. On the ground your glove I found with a note addressed to me. It read, "Dear love, I've done you wrong, now I must set you free. No longer can I live with this hurt and this sin. I just couldn't tell you that guy was just a friend. Moody River, more deadly than the vainest knife. Moody River, your muddy water took my baby's life. I looked into the muddy waters, and what could I see? I saw a lonely, lonely face just looking back at me. Tears in his eyes and a prayer on his lips, and the glove of his lost love at his fingertips. hideous knife. Moody River, your muddy water took my baby's life.
That was Pat Boone with Moody River, which features in The Last Boy Scout, the 1991 action movie I'm about to talk about. Shane Black's script for this movie was the first movie script to sell for over $1 million, and there was a lot of publicity about it at the time. He'd just done two Lethal Weapon movies and a bunch of other stuff, and was kind of flavor of the month when it came to action film script writing. Of course, he's gone on to do a lot of other things. He did the third Lethal Weapon movie, a bunch of other stuff, up to and including the directing and writing of the script for Iron Man 3, which means that he's kind of hit the top of the franchise. He's working on a whole bunch of other stuff now, including a potential Doc Savage movie, which is something I'm looking forward to. And he's kind of very much the flavor of the month now. Joel Silver, who was the action film producer of the time, he'd done things like Die Hard and a bunch of other stuff, and was really the go-to guy for top-end action cinema at the time. Joel Silver decides he wants to make this film, but he gives Shane Black the money. So they decide, who are you going to get directed? So they end up with Tony Scott, Ridley's brother. Now, Tony Scott's had a pretty good career up to this stage as well. He's made things like Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2. Days of Thunder was a bit of a not success, but it did have Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise in it, so we'll forgive him that. So they get him on board to direct The Last Boy Scout. So now they've got to cast it. And their casting thoughts are really interesting to me, because, of course, we know that Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans, he said, not slurring his words, were the people who did star in the movie. But at the time, they didn't know who they wanted to get. So they were looking at some really interesting casting, which I don't think would have worked, but would have been an interesting divergence. Somewhere in an alternate universe, there's this version of the movie happening. They were looking at getting Jack Nicholson to play Joe Hollenbeck, the down-and-out detective played in the movie by Bruce Willis. For the other half of the buddy duo, they were actually looking in a really weird and interesting direction. And they were going to cast Mel Gibson, of all people, as Jimmy Dix, the former professional football player with the drug problem. That was where their thinking was going. Now, it didn't turn out that way for a few reasons, one of which was Mel Gibson was just finished making his Hamlet at the time and was moving into making the next Lethal Weapon movie, because the Hamlet was a bit of a failure, so he wasn't available. They were turned down by Nicholson. So it ended up being Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans. Bruce Willis had just made Hudson Hawk, which was an enormous failure and got a whole bunch of bad press for a number of reasons. And he's playing older than his years in this one. Joe Hollenbeck is a much older guy than Bruce Willis is, and Willis has got to try to play him, which kind of doesn't quite work. But I like Willis in the role anyway. So I'll do a little bit of a plot precy, and then I'll play a little bit of the trailer for the movie to give you the idea of it. And it's a very 1990s trailer. And then we'll talk about why it's such a cool action film. Okay, I'll do the really brief précis from IMDb, which is a down-and-out cynical detective teams up with a down-and-out ex-quarterback to try and solve a murder case involving a pro football team and a politician, and coincidentally, the girlfriend of the down-and-out ex-quarterback played in this movie by Halle Berry.
This ain't no game, Flash.
Joe Hollenbeck's a private detective who's run out of luck.
If you touch me again, I'll kill
you. Two for two.
Told you.
Jimmy Dix.
I like Prince.
Is an ex-quarterback who was thrown out of football.
Another tragic tale of wasted youth.
You're nobody.
Shh. Don't tell anyone.
They were trying to clean up their acts.
You vacuum, I'll dust.
when they got dragged into the dirty world of sports corruption.
So you're going to bribe some senators to legalize gambling?
Legalize sports gambling.
Now,
son, we're going to a ball game.
They've got one shot.
What am I going to do? Point at the bad guys and shoot!
To get the goods. On the bad guys.
This once, I would like to hear you scream.
Play some rap music.
Not about these, man. Take your best shot.
If they don't kill each other first.
That was a bomb?
It had a hell of a factory recall.
Bruce Willis. Damon Wayans. The Last Boy Scout.
Danger's my middle name.
Mine's Cornelius. Don't tell anybody I'll kill you.
Okay, so The Last Boy Scout. This movie has one of the great opening scenes of any action film of the 80s and 90s. There is no question about it. If you've seen the movie, you know the scene I'm talking about. And it's spoilers from here on in, so watch the movie and then come back if you need to. I got the Blu-ray of this one, in fact. I kind of like it. The Blu-ray is a bit of a bare-bones one, and it's in a double pack with Cop Out, the Kevin Smith-directed movie that Bruce Willis did with Tracy Morgan, which isn't anywhere near as good, but it did give me an opportunity to get a Blu-ray of The Last Boy Scout cheaply, so I took it. Anyway, the opening scene of the film where it's raining and there's a American football game going on. Tony Scott makes it look a lot more dynamic than it is, because apparently, from what I understand and my knowledge, is very marginal of that particular sport. You move a little bit, somebody gets hit by somebody else, they fall over, then 10 minutes later they do it all again and keep it doing it like that. It's a very staccato kind of thing. But Tony Scott makes it look interesting. So Billy Cole, one of the LA Stallions team players, gets a phone call while he's in the dressing rooms from someone called Milo, who tells him he's got to win the game, otherwise he's going to be killed. And so Billy Cole takes some PCP, some angel dust, goes out on the field, starts running down the field with a ball and shoots with a pistol anybody that gets in his way, and then finally gets to the end field, turns around, has a great line to say, and blows his own brains out. That's the start of the film before anything else happens. And it's a great opening to a movie. It kind of does show you, really, that this is an action film. The character Billy Cole is played by Billy Blanks, who people remember invented Taibo exercise stuff and did a whole bunch of action films in the 80s. Martial artist, he did a lot of stunt work as well. Very charismatic black actor. So I like that right from the start. That's got me in. I don't give a fuck that it's about sports and I don't like sports. I'm in because Shane Black gives a kick-ass opening scene there. Then we cut to Joe Hollenbeck asleep in his car with a bunch of neighborhood kids crowding around, looking at him, and basically seeing whether he's dead or whether he's awake. And there's a little funny scene there. He slept in his car overnight. He's drunk. He's a down-and-out private eye who used to be a Secret Service agent. And the arc of this film shows a couple of really interesting things, but I'll talk to him a little bit later. So he gets a job from a friend of his who tosses him a bit of work, tells him he's got a bodyguarding job for a exotic dancer called Corey, played by Halle Berry. $500, look after her a bit. There's been some creeps around. She just needs a bit of looking after. He then drives home where his wife, played by Chelsea Fields, is there. And I'm not going to do a spoiler on that part of it, because that part of the movie, all of that right up until the first car explodes, is fucking good cinema. It's really good. The characters are well established. There's a lot of strain in the marriage. He's lost all pride. He's down and out. He's clinically depressed, probably. He's drinking too much. His kid doesn't like him. His daughter, Darian, doesn't like him. His wife is kind of distant from him, and both of them are making some bad moves in their life and in their relationships. So basically the character is set up really well. He's the kind of private eye you used to get in old private eye movies rather than slick, high-tech kind of guys. You don't really get private eye movies anymore. Everything's done on the internet. You get hackers instead of private eyes these days. And it's good to see a good old-fashioned private eye movie with a little bit of balls to it. And this is one. Turns out that Corey, the stripper, has a boyfriend, Jimmy Dix, played by Damon Williams, who's been thrown out of football for gambling. He's got a substance abuse problem as well. Got addicted to painkillers while he was in the sport. And there's a whole arc of the movie. And, yeah, he's got an attitude. He's got a bad attitude. And he meets Helen Beck while Helen Beck is bodyguarding Corey. And they don't get on at first, but as events kind of roll out, they end up working together on the case because, and here's a spoiler again, Corey gets machine gunned to death in front of Jimmy's eyes. But there's a great rapport between Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis in this movie. And this is Bruce Willis before he started just casting checks and before he didn't need to make action films but kept making them because people threw money at him and that kind of thing. And Willis, I've always contended, is a much better actor than a lot of people give him credit for when he's got a reason to. I think he's at that stage of career where he doesn't have anything to prove. He's made his money. He's been really successful at his career. He's got nothing to prove, but he just keeps making movies because that's what he does. And that's a little bit sad. I kind of like the movies where he plays against type. And this movie, in a sense, is a return to type. People say it's a little bit similar to John McClane in Die Hard. But I kind of like it because Hudson Hawk was a big flop and he kind of drew it back a little bit. And Helen Beck is a well-drawn character. For a start, you've got the Shane Black script backing you up. You've got terrific one-liners all through. And you've got a guy with a genuine problem. Well, with a number of genuine problems. And then they put him in the situation. And here's the situation. The whole thing is about a guy who's best friend has betrayed him, and the whole idea is to avenge the best friend who betrayed him and also to protect a politician from assassination, where the politician had actually killed his career as a Secret Service agent. So the things that Joe Hallenbeck has at stake in this movie are things that he doesn't really want. He doesn't particularly want to rescue Senator Baynard, played by Chelsea Ross. He doesn't care really about his ex-best friend, played by Bruce McGill, who gets blown up in a car bomb. But he still goes through with this because he's helping out Jimmy Dix, and Jimmy Dix is actually trying to get revenge for the fact that his girlfriend got machine gunned. And they get involved with the owner of the LA Stallions, Shelley Marcon, played by Noble William, who's a particular nasty piece of work and who's trying to cut a deal with Senator Baynard to legalize sports gambling because he's going to make a lot of money if he does. And to that end, he's got one of his henchmen, Milo, played one of the best villain roles post Alan Rickman in Die Hard in an action film of the 1990s, playing Milo, who's a kind of slightly effete villain. He likes using everyone's full name, calling Joe Hallenbeck Joseph and calling Jimmy Dix James and all that kind of thing. And you've got to have a charismatic villain in there as well. And Taylor Negron, who mostly is known for doing stand-up, he's actually written some plays as well and he's an artist as well. But people know him most for comedy roles and stand-up. He actually did improv back in the early days with Robin Williams, so he really did have a good grounding in that. But he is a good villain in this movie. He's focused, he's weird-looking, and does some very, very nasty things. Joe's daughter Darian gets involved because she's that kind of precocious 1990s action film daughter that you get in those things, played by Danielle Harris. Gets involved in things, and she likes Jimmy Dix because he's a football player and things like that, and he was used to be Joe's favorite football player, and Jimmy only finds that out by talking to Darian. She gets involved with things and is quite crucial to some of the action sequences. And yeah, I mean, there were some great set pieces of action in this film as well. There's the bit where Corey gets gunned down, which was done really, really well. There's a bit involving a stuffed toy cat. There's a really great scene with Bruce Willis and a guy who's about to shoot, blow his brains out, where he uses humor to kind of get his own way and stop himself from being shot just before he stabs a guy in the throat with a piece of broken glass. And it's got some great Shane Black set pieces. The plot doesn't always hold together perfectly, but there is that great warm rapport between Willis and Wayans, which makes it work. There's Tony Scott's direction, which is like pluperfect action film direction of the time. You've got Shane Black's script, and you've got a bit of a subplot that's near and dear to my heart, which is I'm fascinated with the way that professional sport chews up young men, particularly football games of various kinds, and less so with soccer, but more with the kind of body contact football games. The fact that they chew up physically and mentally young men for entertainment value. And that's very much the theme in this one. I mean, look at it this way. You destroy their knees, you destroy their backs, you destroy their groins, you destroy their brains as well, because there is that acquired brain injury aspect to professional sport that they're only now starting to take notice of. And early dementia because of the impacts and the knockout downs and knockouts that people get during professional sport is crazy. And it's got to be one of the few entertainment industries I know of where they basically chew up and spit out the people who are providing the entertainment, and they ruin them physically and mentally. That's a horrible thing. And it's all done for the entertainment of the masses, which kind of does take us back to gladiator things. It's a subtle form of gladiatorial combat football, whether it's Australian rules football or rugby league or gridiron or any brand of football that has body contact. It's gladiatorial games, and the damage just doesn't show for a while. Occasionally it shows with people being taken off in stretchers, but it slowly but surely cripples and kills young men, and that sucks. And that's very much a theme in this one. Particularly, there are a couple of speeches that Shelley Marco makes in the movie, which are very telling on this. But again, yeah, that with that important and kind of serious subtext to it, the film does really deliver the goods. There's a lot of quotable lines in there, like head or gut. And there's the fact that, in a real sense, Joe Hallenbeck is the last Boy Scout. His motto is be prepared. He does the right thing, even when he doesn't really have any particular motivation to do it. He's seeing this through, not because he has to, but because he's helping somebody else out, in this case, Jimmy Dix. He doesn't give a shit about Senator Baynard. He, in fact, hates him and actively works against him in a number of ways. He doesn't really care about Bruce McGill's character being blown up in a car bomb. None of this, but it's his job. His job is to do the right thing. His job is to be the most honest man in his world, and in a lot of ways he is, even if he is an arsehole and even if he is off his face on alcohol at times, and even if he has a bad relationship with his daughter and his wife and really doesn't have his shit together, he still has this overwhelming impulse to do the right thing. And getting the backstory of both him and Jimmy Dix, who has had a number of crippling setbacks in his life, and it's not something he easily talks about, but he does open up to Hallenbeck and tells him what they are, which gives us a real understanding of the character. He's not just, you know, black ex-footballer with a drug addiction problem. There's a lot more to it than that, and there are reasons behind it, and those reasons directly relate to the reason why Corey was killed. And Jimmy Dix's backstory is the engine of the plot for the film. All everything comes from the fact that he was done for gambling and he had a substance addiction problem and was basically fucked over by the system. That is the reason why everything in the film, apart from that first bit with Billy Blanks at the start of the film, occurs. And that kind of works too. I mean, Shane Black's script, while you can poke holes in certain aspects of it, it really is kind of detailed and interwoven and well thought out, and shows why he's got the $1 million for the script. It is a great script. And even though, as I said, Bruce Willis is playing a man older than Bruce Willis in a lot of ways. And, you know, that's kind of cool too, because I like the fact that he name checks Pat Boone and the Four Freshmen and things like that when Corey asks him what kind of music he likes. It's kind of cool. It's the sort of thing that, it's the sort of role that maybe 20 years before you would have seen somebody like Robert Mitchum doing. It's got that kind of tough guy but vulnerable vibe about it. And I like that. I like that fact that Helen Beck's a man out of his time in a sense, and he's kind of seen too many things and lived too long to kind of put up with a lot of the modern bullshit, which is something a lot of us get. You get to where I am in life, and you realize that a lot of the shit you used to sweat over is shit you really should let slide, and the stupidity of modern television is bewildering. The things that people watch, particularly on free-to-air television, appall me in a lot of cases. And that's mostly because we lived in a balkanization of culture. Culture's gone global, but it's gone micro-global. The cultures in the world are all tiny little tribes scattered all across the planet. It's not really, to a large extent, thanks to the internet and television going global and all sorts of things like that. Cultures now are not geographically based, they're more interest-based. And that's going to take us in new directions in the future. And, you know, you may have a certain sympathy for a character like Joe Hellenbeck, who just doesn't buy the bullshit anymore and doesn't care and basically does what he does because it's what he knows. And even though by the end of the film, of course, there's a new direction in both Jimmy Dix's life and in Joe Hellenbeck's life, and he's come to terms with some things that he needs to in a kind of organic way. It's not something that's done illogically, and there are some really nice bits that make it rather than just a pat happy ending, make it a little more complex. For instance, there's bits at the start where the first car blows up. Check out Chelsea Field's reaction to the first car blowing up, and that's a good little kind of hint that the relationship between Joe Hellenbeck and his wife, Sarah, is a little bit more than you think it is. Now, I actually read Roger Ebert's review of this movie from back in 1991, and one of the accusations he made against it was that it's misogynistic. And there can be that argument made for certain parts of it. I mean, it's a buddy action film, which is a genre that does restrict certain things. It's a very specific genre of a very specific type. And there can be the argument that Corey's death is a little bit of a woman in refrigerator moment in the film. And if you're not sure what that is, just Google women in refrigerators and you'll understand what I mean. But I'm going to give it a pass because this movie is so well made. I mean, yeah, you can argue the women in refrigerator aspect of that thing, and the character of Sarah is slightly underwritten, though Chelsea Fields does bring her across very well and fills in the gaps in the way it is underwritten quite well. But arguing that this movie is misogynistic isn't really valid. The bad guys do some nasty things to women. There's no two ways about that. But it's a little bit like arguing that chick flicks have attractive men in them. The whole point of it is that. And I don't think that buddy cop, buddy action films are necessarily misogynistic. And in this case, I don't think it is. I have seen other ones that were a lot more misogynistic, but in this case, the thing I find kind of interesting about the two characters, Jimmy Dix and Joe Hellenbeck, is that at some level, and you'll understand more when you hear Damon Wayans' monologue as Jimmy, they're both family-oriented men in kind of damaged way, and they're not about just, you know, going out having yucks, being a good time guy, that kind of thing. Though Jimmy has strayed from being a family man into something else at the start of the film, but he does get his head right eventually. And I like those slight complexities of character, the fact that the backstories do show them as different men than they are when the movie starts, and that they've got to find their way back from being lost in a lot of ways. And that's not a bad arc to throw into an action film as well. The character is as important in this film. The characters are as important in this film as the action. And that's one of the strengths of Shane Black's work, is that kind of mixing of the two. Neither of these guys is a cliche in action film terms when you really drill down into the characters. So that's probably why I think that The Last Boy Scout is good. It's probably my favourite, apart from Die Hard, it's probably my favourite action film of that era. Because of that, mostly because of Shane Black's script, but also because of the rapport between Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis. Tony Scott and Joel Silver said that it was one of their most unpleasant movie-making experiences, and there was a lot of input from Willis, which wasn't welcomed by the production team. But it doesn't really show on the screen. I think that it does work really well. Apparently there's some little bits that were cut out at the insistence of one of the stars, but it doesn't really show from an audience's viewpoint. So I'm going to leave it there with The Last Boy Scout. I really think that it's worth revisiting now and then. Any Shane Black movie is worth revisiting, any movie that he wrote the script for, because unlike a lot of other action films, it doesn't insult your intelligence. It assumes it's full of characters. Well, it's full of characters with high verbal skills, if you know what I mean. And the action is well thought out and original, and that always makes a little bit of a difference. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, it's time for feedback.
Ooh, we're going to have fun.
Yes.
It's a cozy table, isn't it?
And champagne, my dear.
Delicious.
You like it?
Delicious.
I like it too. Yes, I do like it.
Delicious.
Yes. You want some more?
Delicious.
I knew you'd like it. You always.
Delicious.
Oh, have some more. Get the waiter and. Put on the paper hat. Get out the lamp. I even like the cork. Waiter, four. Keep pouring it. This is every night, New Year's Eve. You got it, every night we're gonna do this. I don't care. Lose the job, everything. What are you gonna do? Scabadoo.
That was Jim Backus and Phyllis Diller with Delicious. Just thought I'd chuck in a little bit of levity there. It's time for some feedback. The first one's from Morris, the guy who's been on the podcast before. You know him anyway. So Morris says, an excellent episode, Terry. Tom was a very good discussion partner for you on the show and brought much to the table, especially via his info about the Third Man location walking tour. Also, thanks for including your big night discussion with Liz. It did my heart good to hear that she believes the final scene is her favourite ever. Something I've always said about the film. Very different from Big Night. From Big Night is a film called Dinner Rush, but it's also set in an Italian restaurant. It's from 2000. Have you seen that one? I really enjoyed it. No, I haven't seen Dinner Rush. I'm going to have to add it to the list of films to see, and I will on your recommendation, because you don't steer me wrong. Big Night. Yeah, I love Big Night. I want someone to make me a timpano. So if someone wants to cook me a timpano, bring it around. If you make it, I'll give you the address. And we can sit down and watch movies and eat timpano together, because that meal in Big Night is incredible foodie porn. It's just one of the best. And I could go a timpano right now, to be honest with you. So that was one of the feedbacks. Thanks, Morris. Thanks again. And thanks for your support for the podcast, too. It really is appreciated, mate. And I got one from Armin, who's also been on the podcast and, of course, is a great supporter of Paleo Cinema and the Martian Drive-In podcast. Armin says, hi, Terry, I hope you're doing very well. I am. I plan to send you some feedback for a long time, but as usual, life got in the way, and to be honest, I had to wait a bit till I collected decent content to validate an email. Now, you don't have to wait. Anything you want to say, I'll listen to. Really like how your new microphone sounds. This is a great investment for improving the show even further. Not that it sounded really bad before. I liked your recent movie selection. As usual, found some new gems that I have to look out for now. I was a fan of Destry Rides Again for a long time. I still remember the surprise seeing a younger Stewart solving problems with his wits instead of the six-shooter. I watched the Mann-Stewart collaborations earlier and was used to the older, more grizzled and sometimes violent Stewart in those later flicks. Marlene Dietrich was fantastic and definitely a one-of-the-kind personality in this and other movies. Finally, time for a rewatch, I guess. I have to admit that I have never heard of The Seven Thieves, but now we'll be on the hunt for it. With this cast and the heist topic, I'm definitely interested. I'm currently finishing the third season of the wonderful TV show Boardwalk Empire. This will now possibly move close to the top of my most beloved TV series, close to The Shield, and luckily there are still two seasons to go. In addition to the great acting, dialogue, costumes and set design, I think the show has potential to present some historical facts properly and explain the delicate connection between the underworld and politics. Maybe the 20s are not so different from the present in that respect. I love the fact that Buscemi can play a lead and dominate other actors around him with a mixture of intelligence and ruthlessness while still showing emotion to specific people. It's amazing how great the casting works in this show, down to the minor but very important characters like Chalky White, Michael K. Williams, and Gaston Means, Stephen Root. Both give just wonderful and deep performances in a very limited screen time. Yesterday I found and immediately watched a new Austrian Western drama called Das Finisterre Tali. I think there's not yet an English title, but you could translate it roughly to The Dark Valley. Sorry, it was Las Finisterre Tal. My mistake, Armin. I apologise. I love the setting and the atmosphere of this interesting flick starring a young Sam Riley. I've honestly never seen him before, and a lot of Austrian actors with great faces and beards. As inhabitants of a remote Austrian village in the mountains hosting a dark, dark secret. There's a strong vibe of The Big Silence and High Plains Drifter in this one. I just loved it. This very strong movie comes highly advised for once we could actually see a movie released earlier on our side of the pond, but I hope there's an English subtitle release very soon. The movie should be seen by many more people. So I'm going to say that again just so everyone gets it. Das Finisterre Tal, The Dark Valley. Weirdly enough, I watched another Valley-related movie just before that. The Last Valley is an interesting flick starring Michael Caine. Omar Sharif and Nigel Davenport. In addition, it had been directed by author James Clavell, who, amongst other things, is responsible for Shogun. He's also an Australian, by the way. Being one of the few films I know that dramatises a terrible 30-year war in the 17th century, this movie is an interesting play on the conflict of religion and common sense, as well as the terrible things men do to each other in the name of some higher power. Kane is very strong as a cynical, intelligent mercenary captain who tries to stay alive in the dark time. He's a great chemistry with Sharif, who is trying to work as a kind of diplomat between soldiers and peasants, so they both want to stay alive. It's an amazing scene where Kane confronts the fanatical local priest, stating that there's no God really. Strong stuff. Okay, I've rambled enough. Thank you for your wonderful show as usual, and have a great day, evening, night. Your biggest fan in Germany, Armin. Thanks for that, Armin. I read that badly, and I do apologise, mate, but The Last Valley I saw years ago, and I'm going to have to revisit it. I know where I could acquire a copy of it, not mentioning anywhere in particular, but I do want to see it. It's nice, I know a lot of movies, as everybody knows. But it's nice to have a reminder of some of the ones that have maybe slipped underneath the radar at times. And I think The Last Valley is one of those. And I'm going to have to revisit it. Of course, it's got Nigel Davenport in it, and I've never really been disappointed in anything I've seen Nigel Davenport in. But yeah, I haven't watched Boardwalk Empire. It's one of those things where those HBO-type series suck up all the oxygen if I let them. I haven't even really caught up on things like The Walking Dead or anything like that. Sal watches them, but I really, between the movies and the podcasts and kind of discretionary watching, it's getting to the stage where I don't have as much time as I'd like to watch TV series. I'll probably grab all of this stuff on disc at some stage and just gobble them down, but at the moment, the to-watch pile is pretty big, and it's not even a pile now. It's a virtual pile in a sense. I've got a lot of things on hard drives that I really want to get around to watching and haven't had a chance to yet. But I can add Boardwalk Empire and The Last Valley and Das Finister Tal when I get a chance to. I'm always happy to take recommendations. I love that stuff because, of course, what I'm doing here is recommending movies to other people, and when they do that back to me, it makes it a little more reciprocal, and I kind of enjoy it too. So if people got recommendations for things they want me to watch, let alone put on the podcast, they can do that. Now, I do have to do this. I do have to mention again the Patreon campaign. I did get another subscriber, Elaine, who is a scientist friend, and she's supported the podcast as well. But we can always use more. I mean, you know, I can always upgrade to a cabana somewhere in a tropical paradise if I get enough supporters, which would be kind of cool. Wouldn't you love to hear me doing the podcast with the sound of the wind blowing through palm trees and the sound of me sucking drinks out of a coconut with a straw as the tropical waves lap quietly on some bleached beaches? That's why you should support the podcast. So basically I can turn into a Gilligan's Island podcaster. But anyway, if you go to patreon.com/paleocinema, there have been some people who tried to search for the podcast on the Patreon website, and it hasn't been there because their search engines are a bit wonky, and they've apologised to me for that. I sent them an inquiry and they apologised. But I'd love the continued support of the people who are subscribing to the podcast financially, and of course the people who just download it as well. It's always nice to get ears. But I've got to do that, and I've also got to add an extra credit for Elaine to the cast list. So I was thinking, given that you're a scientist, Elaine, I may make you the scientific advisor to the podcast because a lot of movies have scientific advisors. So I think I will make that your official movie credit title for Paleo Cinema Podcast. And, of course, we have our rattlesnake wrangler, Matt, as well. So I'm going to play out the credits apart from those two, which I've got to add to a new credit recording. And in the meantime, enjoy your movies. I'll be back in a week with another Martian Drive-In podcast, and in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema podcast. I'm going to have to record ahead for a few of those, so that's going to be nice and challenging for me. But on the other hand, I've already watched the movie for the radio gig, so I can cut myself a bit of slack with that. So take care of yourselves. Stay warm if you're in a cold place. Stay cool if you're in a hot place. If you're in the middle, you're a lucky bastard. And I'll be back after a little time. Catch you later. And as usual, thanks to the people who have subscribed via the Patreon campaign and donated just a little bit of money toward the podcast recording costs. And as a part of that, everybody gets a credit in the style of a movie credit. So we have to thank Alyssa, our location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jan, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the music director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, also known as the first assistant director, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the Technicolor consultant, and Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thank you to everybody who's been involved, and if people do want to get involved, they can go to patreon.com/paleocinema.